You've heard of Grammarly, and you might think it's a fancy spell check, but people on your team have been using it and loving it for years, because it does way more than you realise. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that works seamlessly across apps and websites and can write an instant first draft in a few clicks, not a few hours. When every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, companies can save 19 days per employee per year. Learn what better writing can do for your company at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
I'm Caroline Hyde at Bloomberg's World Headquarters in New York.
And I'm Ed Ludlow in San Francisco. This is Bloomberg Technology.
Coming up, hawks hit stocks, Jerome Powell spooks markets. That's as Mike Wilson over at Morgan Stanley warns growth equities face pressure ahead. We'll bring you the details.
Plus, more job cuts at Meta. The Facebook parent's planning to lay off thousands as soon as this week. More on our Bloomberg exclusive ahead.
And China shakes up oversight of its vast tech arena. That's as Xi Jinping focuses on fending off US sanctions and achieving self-sufficiency in areas from AI to chips. All that and so much more coming up. And there is a lot to digest in the macro part of these markets today. It was one of a perspective coming from Jerome Powell, coming out fighting, and we see that maybe the Federal Reserve is not done tackling inflation. NASDAQ falls 1.25%, so big tech on deck. We look at all country world index. In fact, all this worry around what the Federal Reserve, the central bank to the world, will do affected European trading. We're off by 1.3% when you look at the all country benchmarks. And I'm looking at this inversion. This, of course, is that the two-year bond yields, the cost of borrowing at the two-year is higher than at the 10-year at the moment by a full percentage point. So we see negative 104 basis points when you're looking at the level inversion. This signals the worry that the market has about a recession to come. Flip it on a gear. Let's look at the US dollar strength that we saw on the back of that hawkish tone. It meant that Bitcoin is under pressure too, up by 1.9%. And Chair Powell, Ed, having some fighting words for crypto in particular as well.
Yeah, those fighting words, they were the main driver when it came to single stock names in the equity markets. Although some individual stocks I looked to, Rivian down 14.5%. The company plans to offer $1.3 billion in green convertible notes. That could potentially have a dilutive effect on outstanding shares down the road. Tesla under pressure down 3% as Musk talked about Twitter's debt burden. Amazon was down 0.2%. Alphabet parent of Google down 1.3%. Those two names, Goldman's top tech picks for 2023, that didn't do much to support the stock after Fed Powell made those comments. Then Meta, I won't actually just show the trading. Meta had been markedly higher after my colleagues and I reported that more layoffs are coming in the thousands as soon as this week. And then post Powell completely fell away, actually ending up trading down 0.2%. That is the effect that Chairman Powell is having in this market, Caro. And we go back to basics. We haven't talked about this in a little while, but the prospect of higher rates, discounting the present value of future profits, particularly for that tech sector, and then you price in that recession risk, which is now back on the table as well.
But this is the conundrum, of course, that the Federal Reserve has to focus on. When you've got inflation right, still well above the 2% target, it affects the labor market. As you have been reporting with the likes of Meta, companies have to start to squeeze. They have to put, you know, jobs on the line. And I thought that Elizabeth Warren, of course, really coming out and asking, look, what do you say to those jobs that are going to be lost? And Chair Powell saying, I tell them that everyone is affected by inflation. But Ed, dig into the micro detail that you've been reporting out. Just tell us a little bit about, well, what the under duress over at Meta, whether this is something we can read across to the rest of the tech market.
Yeah, understanding from sources is that VPs and director level staff are making lists. These are new layoffs, thousands of new potential job cuts on top of the 11,000 from last year and on top of the flattening of middle management earlier this year because they're still under duress, right? This is the year of efficiency. It's just that more's needed to get there.
And when we think about efficiency, many would say that's, of course, why techy, growthier names are being focused on because suddenly their future growth perhaps looks less certain. It's what we've heard time and time again, particularly from some of the Uber bears out there, one of them being Morgan Stanley's Mike Wilson, who says once again, even though we saw the sell-off of 2022, you could see a 20% downside for the growth names. Just take a listen.
I think there's plenty of stocks that are probably going to go bankrupt. You know, I mean, I don't think that's a crazy statement, but that's not the bulk of the stock market. Okay, so this is a pocket of the stock market, and then I would say, but overall, like the growthier stuff and the thing, even the cyclical names that have gone too far now could have as much as 20% downside, no problem.
Growthier stuff. Let's talk about, well, one particular analyst who looks across the whole gamut of technology, TMT names in general, Needham Managing Director and Senior Analyst, Laura Martin. Laura, it is so good to have you on the show. And just tell us the breadth of companies that you analyze. Are we currently throwing everything out with the bathwater at the moment because we're worried about future growth, no matter who you are?
Yes, because as bond yields go up, bonds look more attractive as a substitute to equities. So we're getting net equity outflows into the bond market. That makes sense economically. And that's a higher like level of the capital structure. So they have lower risk in case somebody does go bankrupt. And I think specifically as you get this advertising downdraft, advertising has 80% margins. So Google, specifically Google and Meta, or Alphabet and Meta, really are going to be under margin pressure if we go into recession and if advertising demand gets worse.
Laura, in the context of multiples on some of the names that you cover, what's the biggest concern to the market right now? Is it this idea that rates will go higher in bigger increments, or are we starting to get more and more concerned about how deep a recession might come?
So the biggest concern is in a discounted cash flow, which is the academically rigorous way to value these companies. If you have a higher discount rate, any cash flow that comes from like year four in future, like Amazon is making no money, Meta is having, you know, really in a downdraft in its profit margins, that all those out years become much less valuable. And so what you care about a lot is current year cash flow and next year's cash flow. And on that score, Apple, $90 billion a year of cash flow, like super safe, feels like a good place to hide, super liquid. Google still continues to have high free cash flow. We'd like them to cut costs faster, but a lot of their value is not past year five, which in a rising interest rate environment, those past year five cash flows are really discounted harshly.
Let's dig in on actually the only name that you haven't underperformed on, and it's Meta. They are trying to talk up efficiency in particular. They are, of course, looking towards their four jobs that are on the line, Laura. But ultimately, I've looked at some of your decks on this company after their earnings. You said you'd like the word efficiency, but are they just rearranging, well, the chairs on the Titanic is one of the phrases you used.
True. I mean, I think the question we're asking is, does Meta have a terminal value in its core business? Because one of the data points we're reading is most of the layoffs the CEO, Mark Zuckerberg, is making sit in the core business of Meta that's being undermined by TikTok. Assuming TikTok doesn't get banned, the question we have is, in the core business that funds the metaverse, does he actually have a terminal value? Or does he just lose all his creators and all his users in the first world countries to TikTok instead, assuming it stays in business? I think that's a very real question for these network effect businesses that benefit from network effects on the way up, but get slaughtered by network effects like MySpace did on the way down.
Yes. Laura, how worried are you about brain drain? I find this really interesting. One source described this latest round of layoffs to me as more of a sledgehammer. If the 11,000 in November were done with a scalpel, this is a sledgehammer. And I wonder, what's the risk that they lose all of these smart people that are trying to drive this longer-term transition so they don't even get there?
Agree 100%. I think it's hard for morale to lay off people. I think what happens is, if you're not sure you're going to get laid off, your most talented people go and proactively look for another job and get hired away. So who you end up left with is the people who can't get the next job. So you end up with the people that are the worst of the bell curve, not the best, because the best people go somewhere else where their job security is intact.
Lastly, though, when you hear about actually other areas of focus, particularly for analysts at the moment, are saying one area that could perhaps be an upside potential is artificial intelligence. Are you buying that, Laura, particularly for some of these big companies that you monitor?
So it's a great question. So last year was the year of the metaverse. I think this year is going to be the year of AI. So the best question is, when we're sitting here a year from now in early 24, is anybody talking about AI, or have we moved on to something else? I think most of these big tech companies have been using machine learning for a long time to make their recommendations better, to sort their search pages. They've all been using machine learning. You know, sort of ChatGPT and generative AI is new to the consumer market, but a lot of these tech guys would say they've been using AI / machine learning for years. So I don't know whether AI is as big a deal for these large tech-driven companies as it is for the consumer, where suddenly there's a use case that's really exciting in both, like, both pictures and in you know, answers.
We're going to be putting that to a key Salesforce executive a little bit later. Needham Managing Director and Senior Analyst Laura Martin, what a day to have you on. Thank you so much for spending the time.
Time now for the VC roundup, and we're starting with payment platform startup Airwallex, backed by Tencent, which just acquired an online payment business license in China. The transaction cleared all regulatory hurdles with Chinese authorities and now allows Airwallex to become a third-party payment provider in the world's second largest economy and boost its access to the local market. The founders of Argo AI, the autonomous vehicle company that was shut down last year, are launching a new self-driving business that could specialize in trucking and ride-hailing, according to sources. Amazon, which almost rescued Argo last year but eventually pulled out, is not an investor in the new firm. And finally, Salesforce's VC arm is launching a new $250 million fund, its largest to date, to invest in, guess what? Generative AI startups. The enterprise giant also unveiling new tools integrated with OpenAI's technology and dubbed Einstein GPT. They will be used for functions such as drafting customer service response or initial sales emails. We'll have more on that later this hour, of course, Caro, with Salesforce's Service Cloud CEO, Clara Shi.
And Ed, to that point, we were just hearing from Laura Martin saying, look, so many of these big tech companies have been using machine learning and other forms of artificial intelligence for years. And I thought it was really interesting that through Einstein, Salesforce AI is actually, they've been using, 200 billion AI-powered predictions per day anyway. So what really is this large language model going to be adding to in terms of their overall provision?
I think I've got a smile in the corner of my mouth, right? Because you say it, Salesforce, OpenAI, GPT in the headline. But it goes back to what everyone's been telling us on the show. Enterprise is where they see the most promise for these applications. It's just the headlines keep on coming.
And it's not just enterprise-focused software companies using it. There's banks. I've been hearing of plenty of financial companies really trying to harness the power of artificial intelligence. We can dive into that a little bit now with Stephanie Chu, general partner over at Portage. It's a global investment platform focused on fintech, on financial services. You've got, $3 billion in assets under management. You've recently just closed a $655 million Fund 3. It's one of the largest early-stage venture funds out there in the world of fintech. And so therefore, Steph, artificial intelligence, is that a hype that you're hearing, or is it a reality that you're investing in?
It's definitely the one exception to the macro that we've been seeing. And I would say we back the world's most innovative financial services companies, and we're already seeing interesting applications beyond enterprise and beyond the obvious, which I think most people would think, you know, how can AI in a large financial institution really improve customer service? That's kind of the first most obvious place. But I do think it can enable so much more in the future. I can imagine a world in which your complete financial picture as a consumer is actually completely automated by AI. So it's beyond just being able to interact in natural language, but also be able to actually have the AI and or machine learning do things on your behalf.
Steph, I know an area in fintech that you're really positive about is vertical SaaS. And what I wanted to ask you is, do you make bets on AI-related startups, or do you make bets on the companies and startups that will benefit from other AI tools? Do you see what I mean?
I'm much more excited about vertical specific SaaS than I am about horizontal AI, because at the end of the day, I think you still need very specific semantic subject matter expertise and a focus on a specific target segment in order to create a great product experience. So we have always been focused on know your customer, serve your customer well, and AI is going to be a tool that allows you to better serve that customer and that segment. So ultimately, I think we're much more bullish on the vertical focus rather than the horizontal technology, which I think at the end of the day is probably going to be owned by the likes of OpenAI. Ultimately, and I would add one other thing, which is in the future, if the models are in fact kind of commoditized, what really matters is the very specific data that you have. And proprietary data becomes the moat and the major advantage. And therefore, that also favors vertical specific applications versus horizontal applications.
Steph, I wanted to talk a bit about the environment that we're in. Matt Harris from Bain Venture Capital Partners has been on the show recently. We had Layla Sturdy from Capital G, both basically saying, actually, it's a great time to be writing checks, particularly at the earlier stage of the curve. Do you kind of agree with them that there's a lot of opportunity in this moment?
I would say it depends on how you think about what early stage is. I think across the board, because of where the Fed rates are, risk assets are now out of favor. I would say the largest impact has been on Series C and Series D in the market, where we've seen valuations drop more than 50% at Series D, really mirroring the public markets dropping 70%. Mm. I would say seed and Series A valuations, which are on the earlier side of the curve, we've also seen a trickle-down effect there, but it's been the biggest lag. So valuations there have dropped more like 10 to 25%. Across the board, I would say it is a great time to be a venture investor. However, the later stage venture deals, where there's been an exodus and an imbalance of supply and demand in terms of capital, have seen the largest valuation fallouts.
When you're looking at the early stages you do, Steph, where in the world do you focus? Because what's really interesting about your portfolio is it is so global. I'm looking at French, German insurtech companies, for example. Is Europe right? Is it still about the US? Is it Asia?
I would say we've got a really global portfolio. About a third of our portfolio is in Europe. There are very significant, as you guys would know, regional differences even within Europe in terms of where the regulatory environment is going, in terms of if you look at the differences between banking, insurance, and wealth management. So we see global macro trends as being really interesting. There's investments to be made in Europe, investments to be made in North America. I would say in times like this, where valuations have decreased globally, we tend to see flight to capital to larger, more established markets like the US, like the UK, et cetera. But obviously within fintech, you need to be aware of the regulatory nuances of each specific country that you operate in.
Steph Chu, general partner at Portage, thank you so much. You know, we're moving our showtime next week, earlier in the day, 12 Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific, and we want to take that global view. You know, it's interesting to have a partner on that looks globally and outside of North America. Now, let's turn very quickly to crypto. Grayscale's fight over its Bitcoin ETF begins in court. We bring you the latest details out from Washington, D.C. That's next. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
We're watching what's been happening in the crypto space. And, you know, what we see is, you know, quite a lot of turmoil. We see fraud. We see a lack of transparency. We see run risk, lots and lots of things like that. And so what we've been doing is making sure that the regulated financial institutions that we supervise and regulate are careful, are taking great care in the ways that they engage with the, you know, with the whole crypto space.
Some of Fed Chair Powell's remarks on the crypto market, of course, this morning on Capitol Hill. And in fact, some other news in terms of crypto. A few minutes ago, we just learned that Binance US has indeed won court approval to buy Voyager Digital, allowing Voyager to end its bankruptcy, repay customers, of course, all of this following the fallout of FTX. Also today was the start of a court fight between Grayscale Investments and the SEC over plans to convert, well, it had hoped to convert, its $14 billion Bitcoin trust into an ETF. Pleased to say, our new resident in town of DC, one Kaylee Lyons, who we miss a lot from New York, but doing amazing work from Washington, including your crypto show, Kaylee. Just talk to us about actually what felt a lot of questioning coming out, fighting almost on behalf of Grayscale.
Yeah, really the tone of the three judges on this appellate court today really seems to have shifted the odds of many people of Grayscale actually coming out with a victory here. Our own analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence, Elliot Stein, previously had a 60% chance on the SEC being victorious. In this case, they now actually think it's 70% odds in favor of Grayscale because the judges did seem skeptical of the SEC's argument that Bitcoin futures should be treated differently than Bitcoin spot. Of course, that's the argument that Grayscale has been pushing against, saying you should be treating futures and spot the same concerns about fraud and manipulation the SEC has should be applicable to both. And it did seem like those three judges may be more sympathetic to Grayscale's view, hence the market reaction we're seeing today, saw today, GBTC up 9.6% on the day, so that discount to its net asset value narrowed.
Right. The market's going to try and discern what the outcome's going to be, right? There's a risk in that.
Of course.
And you know, you're always hesitant to say, oh, what would happen if? But in the event the ruling falls in Grayscale's favor, it opens some doors, right? What does it mean for them and for this industry?
Yeah, if is obviously the operative word there, and it could still be a while before we ultimately get a ruling, like second or third quarter. And then when we do, it matters what the language in that ruling is. Should the court rule in favor of Grayscale and push back against the SEC's rejection of this application, does it actually force them into accepting it, or could it leave a door open for the SEC to slap it down another way? That will be really important. But of course, if Grayscale ultimately is able to make this conversion, it would get rid of their net asset value discount problem because it would allow redemptions. It would potentially turn into an ETF, and it could mean that other products like it could be introduced in the market in the future.
And just, we broke just before you came, of course, the news regarding Voyager being able to be sold to Binance US. There were other assets on deck when it comes to FTX, and actually it looks as though they're delaying the auction briefly.
Yeah, Ledger X, which was their derivatives platform, it was actually one of the few areas of the FTX empire that remained solvent, had its auction delayed from today to March 22nd. Unclear the reason why, but that's something we're going to have to follow.
Bloomberg's Kaylee Lyons, our voice, FinReg voice out in DC. Thank you.
The U.S. claims that it seeks to outcompete China, but does not seek conflict. Yet, in reality, its so-called competition aims to contain and suppress China in all respects and get the two countries locked in a zero-sum game.
Welcome back to Bloomberg Technology. I'm Caroline Hyde in New York.
And I'm Ed Ludlow in San Francisco.
And Ed, that was just China's new foreign minister there, calling the U.S. approach to Beijing a reckless gamble. And this, of course, is sort of put in stark contrast with what was happening on the Hill today. Congress moving yet closer to restricting access to China's TikTok app with a new bipartisan bill aimed to protect U.S. user data. Clearly, the hostility is front and center when it comes to trade, to technology. We've got the perfect guest to discuss it all. Paul Triolo, Albright Stonebridge Group Senior Vice President of China and Tech Policy. You're about to go out to China soon, Paul. Just talk to us a little bit about, first and foremost, what you heard from Chinese leadership today. A really tough stance, finally, seemingly, that they've decided to fight fire with fire in some way.
Yeah, I think it's not surprising. This sort of rhetoric has been, Xi Jinping has been very careful not to use this fairly straightforward rhetoric in calling calling out the U.S. policy on China. So it's not surprising. It's come on the heels, of course, of the balloon incident, the cancellation of Secretary Blinken's visit to China, and then a whole host of U.S. actions, export controls. And other restrictions on Chinese technology acquisition. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we've had Congress, the hearings last week that kick off a season of hearings with the House Select Committee on China, for example, which, you know, used some pretty harsh rhetoric. So it's not surprising to see China push back a bit on this, but it is unusual for Xi to use such strong language.
Before we get into the tit for tat and perhaps what's happening in terms of privacy here in the U.S., I'm interested in what you made of the shakeup when it comes to trying to ensure AI, particularly chip making, is front and center for China, that they don't somehow lose out despite these trade embargoes and issues that are put on hold in terms of getting hold and access to certain U.S. technologies.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think the restructuring that we're seeing coming out of the NPC, and of course it's early days here, it reflects to some degree in the technology sector this recognition that the U.S. is putting increasing pressure on key priorities for Beijing, like advanced computing. So we've seen the U.S. take action, for example, on export controls, and there'll probably be some restrictions on outbound investment. So I think China is still grappling with the full implications of that, and there'll be a lot of focus on domestic investment in these key hard and core technology sectors, for example, like semiconductors and artificial intelligence. But I think that Beijing is really struggling to figure out a way to keep investing in its domestic industry and push back probably at some point on some of these restrictions we're seeing the U.S. erect around China's companies' access to critical technologies.
Paul, as we came on air about 30 minutes ago, a headline hit the Bloomberg terminal, a news story. Xi's frustration at Biden grows with warning of conflict. And it talks about how a lot of the communications coming from the new foreign minister, Gang, but actually Xi himself is under a lot of pressure domestically with the economy having to pivot policy to be supportive of industries that they have been cracking down on for a number of years now. How does he manage that process, to your mind?
It's a good question. It's very complicated. I think at one level, coming out of the zero COVID restrictions, China has sort of pivoted in the economic and social sphere to show that it's open for business. And so part of the game is to show foreign investors and businesses that China is sort of back on track after some difficult period of zero COVID lockdown. So that's one issue. But at the same time, China is facing the U.S. restrictions on technology and also, of course, concerns around China's continued support for Moscow and talk in Washington and in European capitals about the potential for sanctions. So as Xi surveys the landscape here, it's opening up and trying to portray business as usual, but China's facing a lot of pressure, outside pressure, that's going to push against that.
How successful, to your mind, has China been in leveraging some of the U.S. Partners and allies in getting around this technological blockade? You know, it seems as if the U.S. is convincing most of the Western world to go along with it.
That's very much a work in progress. It's tricky because in some areas like export controls, of course, there have been intense negotiations between the Dutch government and the Japanese government about aligning with some of the tough controls that the U.S. put on in October. But with all these kinds of collaborations between allies that the U.S. is trying to align to contain or constrain China in some of these technology areas, the devil really is in the details. And it can be tricky to get countries that may not have similar kinds of export controls or investment restrictions to go along with this. So it's very much a work in progress. But yes, clearly China is very concerned about this and is working overtime to try to push, for example, for better relations with Europe and try to sort of drive a wedge between the U.S. and Europe on some of these issues.
Talking of relations with Europe, ByteDance CEO has been out there trying to woo in many ways European regulators, same as they have been here in the United States. But different tactics being taken on. At the moment, the EU seems to be more inclined to listen to how ByteDance might be able to put in place restrictions to data flow from TikTok use. Just talk to us about the data, the privacy argument that's going on here in the U.S. vis-a-vis China.
Yeah, and obviously TikTok is sort of the poster boy for this. So TikTok has been very aggressive as part of its negotiations with the U.S. government that have gone on for about 2 years now, installed to be more public about the kinds of procedures it's putting in place to protect U.S. citizen data. So over the last month, yes, the TikTok CEO has been very outspoken in discussing all the measures they're taking, which are pretty considerable. They spent something like $1.5 billion to architect a sort of U.S. enclave that protects user data and protects against things like censorship and things like, and they're also allowing review, for example, of their AI algorithm. But they have a tall order to convince the U.S. Congress and others in the Biden administration that they're taking enough steps to protect U.S. privacy and U.S. user data. The CEO will testify in front of Congress on March 23rd in front of a House committee, and that will be a key indicator of how successful TikTok sort of spin is in terms of convincing U.S. regulators that they've taken enough steps to protect U.S. user data. The Europeans are also watching this very carefully, of course, to see how that comes out.
Paul, with all your knowledge of China and its leadership, are you convinced?
Well, I've seen the TikTok proposal, and it looks to me like it's pretty tough. They decided not to contest the national security concerns that the U.S. government was putting forward, and so they've architected this system using a lot of very capable cybersecurity and other data privacy experts to try to address those concerns head on. So, at least from what I've seen, again, it's difficult to know the full details, but from what I've seen them present, it looks like it's a pretty serious effort to address the concerns, and they spent a lot of money on this. I mean, $1.5 billion, and they estimate it'll take about $1 billion to run that enclave. And so I think that, that's I don't know any other social media company that's taken those kinds of actions to try to address head on those concerns around data privacy and user data privacy. So it's a pretty impressive effort, at least so far.
The question for DC is if it's sufficient. Paul Triolo, Albright Stonebridge Group, Senior Vice President of China and Tech Policy. Thank you so much. Now, coming up, Elon Musk took the stage at the Morgan Stanley conference in San Francisco. We'll bring you the big takeaways next, including his thoughts on AI. And speaking of earlier of AI, we heard from Citadel founder Ken Griffin with his thoughts on this technology.
This branch of technology has real impact on our business. And I'm actually really excited to see how this changes the world.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice, or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Housing and tech are very quote-unquote interest rate sensitive. Construction and housing, I think, is obvious when you have a short mortgage cycle. But for tech, we had a decades-long equity availability of capital, and that's been shut down by the Fed as well. So those are going to feel the impacts first.
A macro perspective. JP Morgan's Global Wealth Management Chief Tom Kennedy earlier on Bloomberg Television with his thoughts on just how the tech sector is currently evolving amid this new interest rate regime. Let's talk a little bit more about tech. First up, Apple adding a new color to its palette, yellow. The company announced a yellow version of the iPhone 14 and 14 Plus today, adding to the existing midnight, blue, purple, red, and starlight options. And sticking with new announcements, Sonos is revamping its line of home speakers, aiming to go after the market more aggressively. That's while, of course, Google and Amazon are rolling out a few new products at the moment. The audio company now has two new models, the Era 300, it's a form of advanced surround sound, and the Era 100, a replacement for a Sonos One, a key rival, of course, to Apple's HomePod and Google's Nest products, as well as the Amazon Echo. And finally, Uber. Well, it's launching some new features of its own to make airport travel, which I've just done, less stressful. From step-by-step instructions to guide you through the airport to walking ETAs, it's also expanding availability for Uber Reserve offerings throughout the United States and Canada. Meanwhile, Ed, I've got to get your take right now on, well, we get lost in the noise sometimes surrounding Elon Musk, but he did right. take to the stage on the minutiae around Twitter today. It's in a Morgan Stanley event.
He took to the stage, he gave us 10 minutes notice, he tweeted a live link, and then the Bloomberg newsroom just erupted into motion, and we gathered the best and brightest across, and we did a live blog, and well, there were a lot of questions, everything from when's the Twitter executive bench going to be as deep as it is as Tesla? What is going on with Twitter's debt? How is Twitter going to be different to when it was when you acquired it? So much to discuss. Unfortunately, my editor and friend and co-sufferer through the process, Sarah Fryer, joins me on set. There were a lot of takeaways. You and I wrote about a number of them. One was the debt. I think we start there, right? And this idea that the debt is $1.5 billion annually, but he kind of justified the savagery of laying off all those staff. What did he have to say?
Well, he said now that debt is about the same as their cash flow. So they're getting to be cash flow equal, maybe edging towards cash flow positive, which, you know, he went on to say that they are now EBITDA positive. And I just think that this is part of his optimism. We've seen a lot of optimism from Musk, despite spending $44 billion on Twitter, despite doing all of those layoffs. He really thinks that he can turn it around. And not only does he think he can make a cash flow positive, he thinks that he can rake in more from Twitter's advertisers.
We actually kind of learned a little bit about how he's measuring success at Twitter. And you know the social media landscape so well. He said, don't worry about monthly or daily active users. Look at user hours. I think he said 130 million user hours per day is what Twitter is hitting currently. What does he mean by that?
Well, what he means is they have this platform that really has the pulse of the news. It's where everyone's talking about what's happening. and they aren't able to monetize that or make right. money off it through advertising at the level that he wants them to. He said actually he was shocked at how poorly they are turning that attention into money. And one of the barriers to that is he thinks that the ads aren't relevant enough. I think partially that's because Twitter just doesn't gather the same kinds of data on users that Facebook does, that other companies are able to based on their activity. And then the other factor is that there is this big issue about what advertisers call brand safety, which is that we don't want ads appearing next to the latest tragedy or even next to hateful commentary, what people are saying that may... You may just don't want to sell next to that. Yeah. And Twitter, because it's the place for the news, is also the place for a lot of that kind of content that perhaps is not as inspiring. You know, don't necessarily want to think about where you're going to get your next burger while you're watching a tragedy.
When we think about oversight in particular under Elon Musk's watch and safety in many ways. I know European regulators have been thinking about this a lot in looking towards some new laws that are going to put into place to protect consumers come 2024. But it looks as though the US FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, also plans to depose Elon Musk as part of its probe, right? There are a lot of people interested in this.
Yeah, I think that this is a company that is going to come under a lot of scrutiny in part because of the layoffs. You're cutting a lot of staff that previously were hired because of what regulators wanted. They wanted somebody to work on harmful content, to work on taking down information operations from foreign operatives and the like that tried to influence the 2016 presidential election. I mean, there were people in place because they were needed at the time. And Twitter is going to have to untangle, you know, did we cut too deep? Did we get rid of people that were there for a reason? And it's going to be tough to answer regulators. I think Musk is saying, you know, we will make those hires we need to make. But we have a lot of priorities right now.
Sarah Fryer, thank you so much.
We were telling you about this earlier in the show, Salesforce getting in on the generative AI arms race. Let's bring its Service Cloud CEO, Clara Shai, in for more. You've just been on stage, Clara, and you've talked about Einstein GPT. Let's start here. Did you partner with OpenAI because it was the best technology or because it was good marketing?
Einstein GPT, we're really thrilled to announce today at the Salesforce Trailblazer DX event here in San Francisco. Einstein GPT is the world's first generative AI purpose-built for CRM, and we are taking an open ecosystem approach. OpenAI is our initial partner, but we'll be adding additional partners in the coming months.
How does this improve the offering to your CRM enterprise clients? What is it that they're getting out of this?
Now, Einstein GPT is really about combining Salesforce's proprietary AI with an ecosystem of vetted generative AI partners to create personalized content for sellers, service agents, marketers, commerce managers, as well as IT developers. And it's for the employees, it's about making them more productive. And for customers, it's about delivering more tailored, relevant experiences.
Because I believe you already deliver, 200 billion AI-powered predictions per day anyway within Customer 360, Clara. So how does the large language model change things up if you're a user?
That's a great question. So we've been on this AI journey for over 7 years now. We introduced the world to Einstein in 2016, and there are over 215 billion predictions that Einstein it gives out every day today across customer interactions. Einstein GPT is the next generation of our Einstein AI, and it includes generative technology, which means that content gets created for sellers. For example, a draft email to a prospective customer. For service agents, a draft response to a customer service chat or email. For marketers, dynamically generating landing pages and email campaign content. The human stays in the loop they get final say before they hit send.
Hmm. And OpenAI say, look, it allows them to learn more about real-world usage that's critical to responsible development. I'm interested in that responsible development element because it's interesting. Some key financial companies, for example, have been limiting their use, employees' use of ChatGPT, worried about their IP, basically. How are you going to ensure this is a safe space for all your customers to work in?
It's the difference between consumer and business applications. Thus far, a lot of what has been covered in the news about generative AI has been consumer applications that are open-ended and frankly have higher safety and accuracy concerns. In the business space, we can really focus the use case, the job to be done on specifically what does a salesperson need, specifically what does a service agent need to do his or her job.
Clara, the other big piece of news is Salesforce's venture arm launching a new $250 million fund specifically targeting startups in generative AI. You alluded to it earlier about future partnerships, but what are you looking for with that fund?
That's right. Our new generative AI startup fund from Salesforce Ventures is really focused on investing in and nurturing the next generation of AI startups. We believe it's very early days in generative AI, and you know, there's a lot that we don't know yet. And so being able to have an ecosystem play is very important, and also to give our customers choice.
Clara, Ed referenced it at the start, this sort of feels like a PR offensive around AI or a bit of a marketing ploy. But ultimately, you've been doing AI for years. Does it frustrate you that suddenly everyone's talking about ChatGPT, or was it needed, this sort of conversation?
I think it's great. It's created consumer excitement and demand. My 85-year-old neighbor even knows about ChatGPT. And ultimately, you know, businesses, they care about AI in the context of driving business results, especially in this macro environment. How do I close more sales? How do I respond to my customer support issues more quickly? And so that's our true north in developing these applications in an ethical and responsible way.
Salesforce Service Cloud CEO Clara Shai running off stage to be with us. We appreciate it. Thank you so much. Meanwhile, that does it for this edition of Bloomberg Technology, Ed. But we've got a pretty great lineup of top executives tomorrow. It also so happens to be International Women's Day.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to some of those conversations. New names, some of them, but some of them long-time guests on this program. Don't forget, been just an incredible news flow day. You can recap all of it in the world of technology on our podcast, wherever you get your podcasts, Apple, Spotify, or iHeart, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal. 2 days down, three to go before the big move, Caro. This is Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.